I'm in the business of wanting to resurrect that triumphant beast in you.
Welcome to The Boundless Body, the podcast with the somatic doctor interviewing innovative thinkers about their perspectives relating to the arts and sciences of therapy.
Expansion and contraction, that is the primary binary inside the construction of your body plan.
Dr. B is a voyager in trauma resolution who brings compassion and humor to the adventure of healing.
You study science enough and the bottom drops out and you're just like, oh.
Enchanting elements of science, philosophy, and art. Discover the boundless body here on this podcast.
Back to the mystery.
Super excited to have you here today, Dr. Barnaby. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I'm just going to start off with a little bit of an introduction here. Dr. Barrett is a psychoanalyst, classically trained, right?
Yeah.
In the Freudian tradition. He's also a somatic psychologist and a sexuality consultant, as well as a Vajrayana meditation practitioner. He received his first PhD from Harvard and his second from the Institute for Advanced Study of Human Sexuality. He's a qualified practitioner in several modalities of bodywork and has written many books on the topics of psychodynamic philosophy, including The Emergence of Somatic Psychology and Body-Mind Therapy. The Emergence of Somatic Psychology and Body-Mind Therapy. Now, this is the book that really got me interested in you, Dr. Barrett. And what was so cool about this book for me as a somatic psychology text is that it was a really wonderful umbrella exploration of somatics and wasn't beholden to the pattern that's so common these days of branding and getting a somatic psychology brand out there. And you really brought this wonderful critique about somatics kind of being fragmented, and that doesn't serve us as a profession in terms of our credibility. So just wanted to start there by celebrating you for writing an awesome book on that topic.
Thank you.
And I also wanted to celebrate the Parkmore Institute, which you established, which I hope to collaborate with in the future. So welcome again.
Good.
Yeah. All right. So, and you're currently working on the erotic dimensions of healing. So you've published on the topic of Tantra, correct?
Yes.
So really, we're looking at the interface between somatic psychology, sexuality, and the spiritual dimensions of body-mind healing. So we got a lot to cover today. Maybe we can start with this discussion, Barnaby, about the limitations of this branded approach to somatic psychology. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, it's a tragic fact how human beings operate, that you can get really revolutionary ideas and great insights into the human condition. And then suddenly it all fragments into different schools that are competing with each other, each claiming to know more than the next and so forth. You actually see this in psychoanalysis. What was a relatively coherent discipline up from about 1895 to 1930, with a relatively coherent view of the way in which unconscious forces constitute us, fragmented into all sorts of different schools after 1930, and a fragmentation that accelerated through the latter part of the 20th century. So if you now look at psychoanalysis as if you were the proverbial alien coming in on a spacecraft, you'd think, what the hell is this discipline? There's people with entirely different suppositions about the basic bases of human life, entirely contradictory viewpoints, different schools all competing with each other, that to call it one discipline is sort of ridiculous at this point in history. Similarly with somatic psychology, I mean, somatic psychology in some ways is as ancient as can be, and in some ways in terms of North Atlantic cultures, it really got started and started developing in the 40s, the 50s, and progressively through the latter part of the 20th century. And one of the problems with somatic psychology is that it really never was taken in, for very understandable reasons, but not good reasons. It wasn't taken in by major academic institutions. So in a certain sense, it began its course impacting us in a way that was sort of marginalized, I think, from the start. And the result of that has been, and maybe this is just entrepreneurial human nature, though I think that's a kind way to put it, is that all sorts of different individuals started to develop slightly different schools, sometimes profoundly different, but sometimes only slightly different. And then they would brand them with their own name. You know, mine is the such and such school of somatic this or that. And so if you look at somatic psychology coming in from it as the proverbial alien in the spacecraft, you've got you've got many hundreds of different little schools run by individuals who may have tremendous insight, but there's very little cross-fertilization. Even though there are things like the European Association for Body Psychotherapy, the American Association, even though there are those associations that are supposed to pull the discipline together, they're comparatively weak organizationally. So what you get is a fragmented picture of lots of little schools, some of which are doing the same thing as another school, some of which are doing something significantly different. I think there are ways to organize this picture, but it is a rather depressing picture in a way, because you can enter the field of somatic psychology. And I don't know, Dr. Bryan, how you entered it or what your background was, but it's very easy for someone really interested in somatics and in healing to enter the field having not a clue about the whole diversity of the field and learning their little technique. Rather like if someone was to become a doctor in allopathic medicine and skipped medical school and went straight into endocrinology and really didn't know about anything else. And that, unfortunately, is the situation we're in now, which I think makes it so wonderful that you're doing this sort of a program with the attempt to just let's talk about what somatic psychology is and can be and how its future is, I think, absolutely vital. In so many respects, for reasons that we can talk about.
If you enjoy the content, please subscribe, like us, and share. Dr. B offers a dynamic blend of therapeutic maps, modalities to help you catalyze, stabilize, and thrive. Book a session or free consultation at www.somaticdoctor.com.
Well said. So yeah, I mean, just to give you a little bit of background for myself and my own journey, I started as a body worker and I was lucky to be introduced to a sort of radical multiplicity of modalities when I was training. So from, I like to say, aromatherapy to Zen. So I trained as a craniosacral therapist, different styles of craniosacral. I taught that for 8 years. I trained as a rolfer. I trained in spiritual sexual shamanism. You know, and now I'm a neuroscience professor, and I've just listed a few, right? I've really been around the block with many, many different modalities. And that was before I entered my doctoral training in somatic psychology. So I was grounded in the multiplicity before I went into the trade, so to speak, of being a somatic psychologist.
Mm. Well, I salute your tenacity, but not every individual has it. And a lot of people don't have the tenacity to get trained in all these different things that you've experienced. And sadly, that's accounts for the fragmentation of the field, and in which you obviously are a leader in trying to pull it together, which I think is admirable.
Yeah, I like to think, or I package it as an integrative psychotherapy or integrative somatic psychology. And that cuts across the grain of the sort of capitalist endeavor to specialize, you know, where it's like, it can be almost ridiculous where, you know, now psychologists seem to be specializing in treating Or if you're looking for a psychologist, you look for somebody that basically has as close to the same set of experiences and beliefs as you do. You know what I mean? So like, you know, somebody who, you know, got a specialist in vomiting phobia. Like, for example, which we see a fair lot, or I see that a fair bit in clinical practice, is vomiting phobia. Now, I haven't seen a vomiting phobia specialist out there, but I tell you, it could be in the pipeline.
Well, if you are entrepreneurial enough, I mean, you could be a leader in that field. You could become the international expert in it. But I totally get what you're saying. And of course, I think a lot of it is the capitalist marketplace, where people want to make a living and are forced to establish a reputation to deal with the competitiveness of the field. And so they end up branding themselves in these remarkable ways.
Yeah. Well, so I just love the wide holding in your text here, the emergence of somatic psychology and body-mind therapy. And So when you zoom out, you really are inclusive of the different threads that from ancient to modern of what is driving, shall we say, this fractured field now of somatics. It has a very rich history, somatics does, as you've mentioned, but I just want to read out the different headings that you have in your chapter about the history of somatics. Okay. And maybe that can give us a framework for exploring the history of, you know, like why such a fractured field now. So we have, starting with the first one, shamanic practices and transpersonal psychologies. We have the Asian wisdom traditions. We have the tradition of psychoanalysis. We have somatic psychodynamics, which was kind of instituted by Reich. One of the reasons why there is a fracture, right? Because Reich was an interesting character, to say the least. We have the philosophical and cultural studies portion, which is very rich. You know, that critical theory thread that is in your work, which is just so wonderful, as well as the Western traditions of body work. You know, such as you mentioned Swedenborg, Emanuel Swedenborg in your text, which is quite lovely. He is one of the contributors to the development of craniosacral therapy.
Yes.
That doesn't get talked about enough, this piece, right? Hardly a lot of people have forgotten about Swedenborg, which is sad.
Yeah.
And then the last one is the advances of neuroscience, which is just getting more and more clout in the mainstream pop psychology approach to trauma recently. So I really just love how you have this broad framework. Maybe we could just say a few things about each along the way as a framework, starting with the shamanic traditions. Are you game for that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing about these different frameworks, which is would require a huge study to really get to the bottom of, is to what extent and in which directions have they influenced each other? What does cross-fertilization actually achieve, and has there been any? Shamanic traditions in North America, in Europe, and in Asia, and in Africa, where I'm currently located, obviously go back centuries, and they have a sort of inherent indigenous wisdom. They are in some ways quite comparable. There are threads to South American shamanism that pertain to Southern African shamanism and so forth. And in some ways, obviously, there are differences, and there are considerable differences, obviously, in the languaging of the insights and the methodologies that they bring to bear on healing. It seems to me that there's a huge amount to learn from shamanic traditions. The way they seem principally in the last two decades or more, the way they seem principally to have entered into our consciousness is through the use of plant medicine. But aside from the use of plant medicine, there are traditions of understanding subtle energies and subtle energy systems, and the way in which we do or do not listen to subtle energy systems that are in a way quite contrary to the mainstream of the Western tradition of science. In fact, the Western tradition of science, in a way, is highly skeptical when one talks about subtle energies, although arguably less so since quantum reality and so forth. But shamanism, clearly there's a lot to learn from. But, you know, I think the other thing we have to be truthful about is that in all these different forms of somatic psychology that you've started to talk about, and in shamanism, there are a significant percentage of bogus practitioners, just as there are a significant percentage of doctors who really don't know what they're doing in allopathic medicine. So we have to be very discriminating about who we learn from and how. I would love to hear more about your personal journey, because, and maybe we'll do this another time, because the question is, when you're looking for a teacher, you know, you're studying, let's say, Reikian bioenergetics, and then you think you want to actually study how this relates to tantric meditation. Finding teachers is not easy, and there are a lot of self-branding in this field. I don't think it would be any better if it was government regulated. In fact, I think that'd be a nightmare. But there's a lot of self-branding and opportunism, and so there are a lot of bogus teachers. In shamanism, which I'm studying right now quite intently here in Southern Africa, it's well known within the shamanic community that your teacher that you find can very often take money from you and not really enable you to have a profound ethical grounding in the shamanic practices. But we can say more about that. I don't know what questions that raises in your mind or what thoughts you have about that. But I think there's a lot to be learned from shamanism. We know more about it in the North American and South American context than we do, in a way, in the Asian context, but certainly in the African context. There is remarkably little written about shamanism in sub-Saharan Africa, and most of what's written is from West Africa. Southern Africa, which has very rich traditions of healing, not just plant medicine, but visualization and the use of subtle energies and healing practices. It's a hugely rich tradition about which little is known because little has been written down.
Yeah. Well, it's a really deep topic. I mean, one of the things that comes up is what I see is another fracture point between this rich tradition of understanding unconscious dynamics and unconscious power struggles that comes with the tradition of psychoanalysis and with psychological inquiry, where there's a kind of understanding that there can be, that there is an unconscious and that there's shadowy stuff that can take place there. And to me, the spiritualities and the shamanisms can have a way of sort of splitting off and not integrating psychological inquiry about the shadow and losing some of the ethical sensibilities and potencies that go with that tradition. So we have a kind of split between spirituality and psychology, the kind of spiritual override mechanism. And I think that shows up a fair bit in the shamanisms these days.
Yeah, I think that dovetails with something. I thought at one point you were going to ask me, well, how do you make sense? How do you organize all these different brands of somatic practice? And I think one dividing line is that there are those that work with and believe in subtle energies, whatever you want to call them, and those that do not. So there are somatic practices which, like allopathic medicine, really decline thinking about, let alone experiencing, subtle energy systems. And that this occurs in body work. If you train, at least in the countries that I'm familiar with, if you train as a physiotherapist, you don't get taught about subtle energy systems. you get taught, rather like an allopathic doctor, that the body is made up of anatomical structures and physiological functions, and that's it. As I like to say to students, when you become an allopathic doctor, and I have a daughter who is one, from the first day in medical school, you're sort of trained to look at the human body as if it was a cadaver that happens to be alive. It's just anatomical structures and physiological functions. And there are traditions of bodywork which operate just like that. The division, I think, is there an acceptance and awareness and a use of subtle energy systems in the course of healing, which I have come to believe is absolutely vital, spiritually and existentially, for the future of any of these fields, psychoanalysis or all the body psychotherapies. But we still have to contend with the fact that in the mainstream cultures, North Atlantic, there's still a hell of a lot of people who think that subtle energy is hocus pocus.
Yeah, and then on the other side of the river, you have these different modalities that do interface with the subtle body and have a different nomenclature for it. They have a different way of naming the stuff. And it's almost like the naming of the subtle energy then distances the practitioner from the actual thing itself, or certainly from the other tribe or the other folks, the other practitioners that are doing a different modality, and they have a different way of naming the subtle body. For example, who could we pick on? We could pick on the Enneagram folks. We could pick on, you know, folks that do have some sense of a subtle body, but then there's like this really rigid schema and nosology of like what's happening and like what the map and what the framework is. And it's almost like you can't even be in dialogue with these folks unless you have the language yourself. So it's like, I could believe in subtle energy, but there's not going to be able to be a lot of cross-pollination unless I have the language of the person that is running a different modality and language for their subtle energy.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, because there are 101 different languages for what is undoubtedly really the same thing. Maybe not 101, but you get my point. And I think that's something that will change. With the leadership of people like yourself, there will be more cross-fertilization. I think there has to be. And paradoxically, the internet world, which is perhaps the least somatic world that you can think of, paradoxically, actually can help us with that. I went and studied traditional Thai medicine in Chiang Mai in Thailand. And the Thai system, the Sensib system of energy healing, is a strange sort of syncresis. I don't even know if it's a synthesis, but it's a drawing together syncretically of two different things. One is the system of prana from South Asia, and the other is the system of qi from traditional Chinese medicine. And it's just fascinating to look at. There are divergences between what you learn if you go to South Asia, what you learn if you go to Thailand, and what you learn if you go to China. But basically, it's all the same thing. But the complexity of differences can make you skeptical. You know, how the hell can one phenomenon produce all these different vocabularies? But in a way, it's like everyone's pointing to the same thing, only there are somewhat different lenses to look through. If you look at the language of chakras, which has now really entered into North Atlantic consciousness because of yoga and because of the influence of different forms of Buddhism and different forms of Dharmic teaching, if you look at the chakras, you know, typically there are seven. But there are also nine if you count them outside the body. And in Sufism, there are only five. I mean, that's an interesting difference, because in a way, the chakras are very fundamental to thinking about the energy body. But even there manages to be different ways of conceptualizing it or different frameworks for looking at it and for using it in healing practice.
Yeah, one of the things that I like about your work is that you throw Freud into the mix and say, hey, you know, Freud was talking about psychical energy. You know, energy is in there. And despite all of his efforts to be accepted by allopathy and neuroscience and so on, if you put on the lens of looking for the life force archetype, you see it, right? And his concept of psychical energy.
Yeah, he's a fascinating case study, actually, of the way in which the dominant culture ends up depriving us of certain insights. Because he started his work with free association in 1895, and that's really all he did up till 1915, 20 years of experimenting with a free associative method. And in that time, for instance, in 1913, he said, we are compelled to think of psychic energy as coming between, note the word between, it's biology and psychology. So if you think of our biology as the body, as allopaths conceive it, and you think of psychology as the representational systems we have, our thoughts, wishes, feelings, all representational, he's saying that there is a site that, there's a subtle energy that comes between those two realms. It's like we're no longer dealing with the Cartesian body and mind on two sides of an equation. There's something else that runs through them and between them and within them. He believed that in 1913. After 1915, he more or less backpedaled and started making more and more complex theories that were more aligned with Western rationality of the medical tradition he had trained in. To some extent, he really backpedaled on the idea of psychic energy. And that was the idea that Reich picked up and Reich tried to make into a methodology, Wilhelm Reich. Not Theodore. And yet, right towards the end of his life, he writes a letter about telepathy. And he tells his second lieutenant, Ernst Jones, he says, look, my belief in telepathy, and think about what telepathy is. If you and I have a telepathic connection, there's some sort of subtle energy flying between the two of us. You can't otherwise understand it. He says, my belief in telepathy is a private affair and nothing to do with psychoanalysis. And you cannot but think, bullshit. Surely if there is subtle energy and there's telepathy, then it's got to have everything to do with how two people sit in a room and try to heal each other. And that, I think, shows you to some extent. I mean, he was a man of integrity up to a point, but he was also a man of great ambition. And the ambition meant that in some ways, he started to align his theories with an allopathic approach to our body-mind. So ego psychology, which he produced, object relational psychology, which he produced, all those sorts of things that came much later than 1915, are in a way efforts to produce objectivistic theories, which actually fit in with the Western model of analytico-referential thinking, Western rationality as a shorthand. But in a way, what I've argued, and I think it can be shown, is that there was a mystical side to him. And the mystical side he sort of suppressed within himself and within his writings in order to become the leader and the influencer that he was. But it was there, and it was more explicit at the beginning. And he found it through free association, which I also find very, very fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what you're saying really played out in this splitting between Freud and Jung, right? Where Freud, there's this classic narrative. It's almost like a parable now in the community, or it's this anecdote of Freud and Jung being on a ship, and both of them having a ship from America or to America. And they were looking at dreams together, and Freud interpreted Jung's dreams and, you know, did his authoritarian trip with Jung and ran all of his filters on Jung's dreams. And then Jung basically said, all right, Siggy, it's time for us to look at your dreams. And then Freud just totally pulled the authority card and basically said, in order to do that, I'll be losing my authority. So this isn't going to happen.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because you have someone who is a genius, actually had insights into the human condition that were revolutionary, and that insights into the human condition that actually are very close to Asian wisdom and indigenous wisdom systems. And yet he wanted to be Moses. He wanted to be Hannibal. He wanted to be the great leader. And when Jung said that to him, he says, no, no, no. Me, the authority, you, the student. And of course, Jung being Jung couldn't tolerate that. And that was part of the split. The whole thing about Jungianism, which would be a whole other couple of hours discussion, is the way in which Jung himself shifted away from the body. Because in a certain sense, Jung was struggling with the body as fundamental when in 1914, he wrote a series of papers on sexuality. But after that, he goes more and more to the archetypal world, which in a certain sense is a disembodied world. Now, I know that there are Jungians who would immediately take issue with me, but I mean, I think there's something there that is important. There's a very good anthology called Reencountering Freud and Jung. And I'm trying to remember, I think it was R.S. Brown was the editor of it, which looks at, you know, what now contemporarily can we make of why Freud and Jung became such different and adversarial ways of looking at psychoanalytic or analytic thinking.
Yeah. It's interesting that, you know, Freud totally turned his back on the occult vibes by calling it the black tide or the black mud of occultism. And I hadn't heard that piece about telepathy towards the end of his life. You know, both of them in some sense turned their back on paganism and on, you know, the kind of occult knowledge and esoteric knowledge of the subtle body. And I'm totally with you on that. And I'd love to have that conversation because, you know.
Well, it's a fascinating history. And yet, you know, what did he have on his desk? Statues, including a statue of Vishnu. They had the Hindu deity. And in the last 2 years of his life, he was visited by a Japanese psychologist whose name I can't pronounce and I won't try. He was visited by a Japanese psychologist and had an hour's discussion with this guy in his study. And he leaves the study and he bursts into Anna Freud's room and said, this is what we've been talking about all along. And the guy had been talking about Buddhism and the Japanese traditions of Buddhism specifically. So, I mean, it's a history that volumes can be written on. But I think the point for us today is that too many people in the somatic psychology universe have totally rejected psychoanalysis as being completely cerebral, as being too intellectual, disregarding the body. And it's an understandable rejection of psychoanalysis. Rather like feminists rejecting psychoanalysis because he was quite paternalistic and phallocentric, but that misses a whole other foy that actually there's a lot to learn. And particularly, as you know, my interest is how do we learn from free association, which is a little bit like, it's very difficult to do, and it's a little bit like free dance. If you think about free dancing, the first thing that free dancing teaches you is where you're blocked. You know? Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. You do it much
better
than
me. Often in the face, right?
Yeah, the faces. Yeah. But I mean, if you try to move in an improvised, spontaneous manner, in a way, what it rapidly brings an awareness of is where you are blocked. And that's actually the same as free association. Where are we blocked? From opening our bodies and opening our minds up to other things or to the forces within us that make us who we are.
I just love that, Barnaby, because when I get in the room with somebody that has the capacity to free associate in their body and in their mind, something in me just totally relaxes. You know, I just got the tingle response there because I just, it just feels so good to me, right? Because there is so much mobility that's afforded in terms of the life force, you know? This is one of the reasons why I love Deleuze so much and how he talks about how the face gets so shut down. He doesn't use this term. He uses other complex terminology, but in this terminology, the face is one of the commonest areas to shut down from being able to display a type of free associative process, like the muscles of the face. Like, you know, I dance a lot. I do a lot of free associative dancing in the ecstatic dance community, for example. And when I look around at the faces, what I see is faces that aren't doing free association when the bodies are kind of doing the free association. So
that's actually fascinating. I've never thought of that. So there's a disconnect between a body that can move and the facial expressions. Interesting.
Oh, and Deleuze's chapter on faciality is just absolutely genius, talking about how the face is the seat of identity. And, you know, I think we'll talk a little bit more about how language can cut us off from the life force, being indoctrinated into representational language can cut us off from our bodies in different ways with different traditions and different ways of naming things. But what Deleuze is saying is that a primary place that shows up in the body insofar as blocking free associative processes is the face.
Yeah.
Like, think about it. Us doing free association right now with our facial muscles, people would be creeped out watching the episode probably, you know, we'd just be going, all right, you know, and it looks crazy. So people just don't do it. And that's one of the reasons why it's so hard for folks to do free association psychology work, right?
Yes. No, I mean, what you say is very interesting. And if you think about it, and I think this is what you're saying, but I'm understanding it correctly in a slightly different way. The face is so closely aligned with the control centers of the cerebellum that in a certain sense, your face contorts when you're making a mental effort to control the spontaneity that is in the body. I think
you have named it all the way down for me, Barnaby, because my book, Visionary Somatics, that I'm working on right now, is it the neurological component of visionary somatics is the cerebellum.
Yeah.
I go deeply, deeply, deeply into the neuroscience of the cerebellum and how it's connected to the default mode network. So I mean, you really named it, right? Cerebellum, what does it do? Its primary function is sequencing.
Yes.
Okay. And so what does it do? It sequences musculatures in the face, but it also does social sequencing, and it's part of the default mode network, which is our best working definition of what the ego is neurologically now in the brain. So then we have a kind of autobiographical sequencing process that does sequence the facial muscles. So then from the Freudian language, then it's like the face and the way that the cerebellum sequences the facial muscles is an expression of the ego.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Brilliant. So I just wanted to circle back to this amazing framework that you have and just name again that the kind of esoteric elements of Freud got, you know, kind of trampled over by even himself, because he, like, for example, in the early days, he was a mesmerist, wasn't he? He used
hypnosis.
I don't know if you've ever run into the book, The Discovery of the Unconscious by Ellenberger. Have you ever run into that?
Yeah,
book?
Yeah.
It's a brilliant book, isn't it?
It's a classic book. It was when it came out, it was a wonderful counterpoint to Ernst Jones' biography of Freud, which was what's called a hagiography. It was too much of an ass licking piece, but too much flattery. Ellenberger, well, Ellenberger in a way, did an admirable job setting that straight with a more balanced view of how the unconscious came into the discourse of Europe, basically.
Yeah, and Ellenberger is, in a way, is a precursor to you from a certain perspective, because he was able to see in a kind of genealogical way how these various branches of psychoanalytic tradition were rooted in shamanism, where you see a direct development from shamanism and subtle body theories through mesmerism and Anton Mesmer and hypnotherapy and into modern therapies of all kinds. Just brilliant.
Yeah, I so think maybe we can. There's more that could be said there if I can just piggyback on what you've said.
Please do.
Because Ellenberger makes the point that there was all sorts of notions of the unconscious prior to Freud. In romantic philosophy, in people like Goethe and Schiller and people who were very influential in Europe. And we're not even talking about outside Europe now. So Ellenberger makes that point that the unconscious was there before Freud. But if you start emphasizing that point, you lose something that is absolutely central to Freud's insights and that I think is lost in the world of somatic psychology today, which is, it's very clear in at least classical psychoanalytic theory that you can never be fully integrated, that conflict and contradictoriness is an irreparable part of the human condition. Now, we were talking earlier, and I said maybe one way to organize the somatic world is to think about, do you have a notion of subtle energies, or do you decline any notion of subtle energies? And that, I think, is a divide between all sorts of different somatic psychology and body-mind modalities. Some do, some don't, and that's a big difference. It's a big difference sort of philosophically and cosmologically and ontologically. How do you think about the basics of what we work with when we work with somatics? But the other way to divide up the somatic world, which I think is it very much needs to be thought about, is between a psychoanalytic approach which says you can never be fully integrated, that the idea of self-mastery is a pernicious myth. And yet we know that a lot of somatic psychologists and other forms of psychotherapists, humanistic psychotherapists, are selling their method with the promise that you can have self-mastery. You can have self-mastery, you can be fully integrated, etc., etc., which Freud and the psychoanalytic tradition clearly says is a false goal and a falsifying goal. And yet, if you think about the whole American ideology of Dale Carnegie and self-help and mastery and the individual's autonomy and so forth, it's very anti-American ideology to think existentially that one cannot become integrated fully, one can never fully master oneself, that contradiction and conflict is inherent to our constitution, which you and I were talking earlier about normative traumas. It's inherent to our constitution. That, I think, also divides a lot of practitioners, because a hell of a lot of practitioners, implicitly or explicitly, are promising you can be fully integrated, you can be master of your own life. And if that is untrue, as psychoanalysis suggests, then it's sort of peddling a rather pernicious myth that ultimately is not conducive to healing. Perhaps you disagree. Your facial expression suggests that you are. And of course, having heard what you said about the face, I'm now intently monitoring yours.
Well, actually, no, I'm in total agreement. And I'm just an example came to mind because I'm thinking about this split between spirituality and psychology again, because there are these traditions, for example, the Diamond Approach. I don't know if you've run into the Diamond Approach.
Yes.
Almas's work. Where you see this kind of, you see a psychoanalytic and object relations element, which one would hope would carry with it the humility of, there is no such thing as a fully integrated human, but the spirituality element in it can bring in this kind of element of I've arrived at there's a potential of arriving at a fully integrated spiritual place, and a kind of arrivalism that's there within a hierarchy, which to me is the worst of spiritualities, where there's a kind of hierarchical ladder with the person, the guru up at the top or whatever, being the accomplished and arrived one, who then is initiating people up that ladder. And then if it doesn't have a psychological mechanism in there to kind of track things, then it can kind of plunge into unethical stuff. And it gets really complicated from there, right? Because I believe that in the Diamond Approach, they do talk a lot about tracking narcissistic bids and all of this stuff. But it's just I think it's just a thicket now. It's a mess of this kind of marketplace of spirituality and psychology, where both of them kind of converge on a weird type of arrivalism.
Yeah, I'm very skeptical about all that. And it's more than skepticism. It's not just because I don't believe it and I'm convinced it can't be achieved. I believe that the pathway of healing is that one has to be able to listen to one's own contradictions and one's own conflicts and not imagine that they can be transcended. But that's an unpalatable message. And it's an unpalatable message, particularly within the ideology of American culture, the ideology of individualism and of making oneself and so on and so forth. So there are deep philosophical divisions here within all these different brands and practices of somatic and psychological healing that are out there being marketed. And I use the word marketed advisedly, because I think there are really good reasons to be cynical about the way the marketplace favors certain sorts of message that healers put out and disfavors other.
Yeah, right. It's like, you know, I'm propelled to, even though I'm critiquing branding and marketing with you here and the limitations of it, I'm right in the middle of writing a book called Visionary Somatics, a new brand of trauma resolution, you know, theory and practice, right? It's like the system, the best we can do sometimes is just do our best within the system and critique it at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So I wanted to, we've covered a fair bit of shamanic practices. The next one is Asian wisdom, which you've mentioned a little bit. And I'd like to center the discussion on your exploration of Vajrayana, if you don't mind. I think that would be quite cool. That there's an Asian wisdom element. You mentioned Swedenborg, who wasn't quite Asian, but in the book, you do mention how there's a Christian mystic influence in some of the somatic psychologies. And maybe you could talk a little bit about your experience with Vajrayana.
Well,
and just comment on that part of
it. Yeah. Swedenborg, I know a little about, but not nearly as much as you. So I don't think I can address that. And Christian mysticism, I'm not hugely strong on the history of it, although I know quite a bit about various trends of it. Buddhism is fascinating to me, partly because it's an atheistic system. There is no God up in the sky running everything. But what there is the interconnectedness of the subtle energies that constitute the universe, which is like saying that God is the whole of the interconnected energies of the universe. And although people think that Buddha was a god, or people think that Buddhists treat Buddha as a god, the figure of Gautama is really just the figure of a human being who achieved enlightenment. And as you, I'm sure, know, in Buddhism, there are really sort of three what they call turnings of the wheel of Dharma. The first one is Hinayama, which you just have to become a Buddhist, understand the principles of Buddhist practice, the three refuges, the importance of the figure of the possibility of enlightenment, the the belief that there is a method by which one can become spiritually enlightened. Enlightenment now, not as what you just described, I've reached it and you haven't. That's not really a Buddhist idea at all, although people as human treat it as if that's it, and the fact that they're a community. So there's the Hinayana, which is the vast majority of Buddhists. And then there's the Mahayana, and the Mahayana is the next phase up. And the Mahayana really, not phase up sounds very hierarchical, doesn't it? And I don't mean it like that, but it's a different sort of practice. And the Mahayana really breaks down into two forms. One is Zen Buddhism, with which you said you have some experience, and the other is the Vajrayana, which is the tantric tradition that in the 9th to 13th centuries slowly developed in northern India principally, although some. Very strong interest in cultural studies and socio-political studies in the last 10 to 20 years in the way in which oppressed people carry their oppression in their body, and the way in which indigenous communities very often carry marks of the oppression. And this, of course, I don't think any of this interest could have come about without Brandt Spanel's writings, particularly here in Africa, although there are other figures who've been very influential in it. Paulo Freire, for instance, in the South American, Latin American context, also has some things to say about how the oppressed carry themselves somatically as well as psychologically, as well as in other ways. I'm not being very articulate here. I think that the interest here, the thing that I think is important that has really only just been discussed, is intergenerational transmission and the way in which trauma is transmitted intergenerationally. And up till and quite recently, I think we've had rather simplistic models of how that happened. Models that are based on notions of education and socialization. But one of the things that is very exciting in a way and carries great hope, if we understand it, great hope for more powerful modes of liberation, is to think about intergenerational transmission that occurs on very subtle, unconscious levels, not on the directly conscious model of socialization. The direct model of socialization is where parents say to their child, don't hope for too much. You know, don't hope for too much. You're just a person of color or whatever the issue is. And that goes to explain a lot. But the subtleties of intergenerational transmission, the more we can understand them, the more I think there is the hope for a genuine liberation from the white male values that have dominated the globe, and that brought about colonialism. I'm obviously talking very specifically from an African context. You spoke about trauma, and I'm looking forward to reading your book and how you define trauma. For me, it's sort of become a bit of an overworked word. You know, everything is traumatic, and everything is traumatic. I went through looking after 3 years ago. I went through looking after my partner who died of COVID, and that certainly was traumatic. Not just in the loss of her, but in the appalling way in which the death occurred. Very traumatic, very difficult ever to get over. And it seems to me, and yet we bandy about the word trauma perhaps too much, to the point where it becomes rather meaningless. Everything that is challenging to us, every pain that we have to heal ourselves from, is not necessarily a trauma. Doesn't mean it's not serious, but it's not necessarily traumatic. Now, I don't know how, Brian, you define trauma, but for me, a trauma is something that is traumatic because we cannot process it. It's beyond our immediate capacity to process it. That's what makes it traumatic. In Lacanian psychoanalysis, it's an intimation of the real. It's a breakdown in the symbolic order or the representational order's capacity to assimilate and make sense of some experience. That makes it traumatic. Now, in psychoanalysis recently, but only very recently, and only a very small minority of those of us who are psychoanalysts, there is a notion of normative trauma. The fact that we become human because there are two great traumas that we have to endure, all of us. That's why it's normative. And one is Oedipality, which, as you were telling me earlier in an earlier conversation, I wrote a paper about in 1919, which is really the trauma of entering into language, of becoming a signifier, my becoming a Barnaby in a whole symbolic order that I didn't create. It's outside of me and it pre-existed me, and a Barnaby was in the symbolic order, and I, as an I, had to in some way enter into, be inducted into that symbolic order, which is an Oedipal trauma. And I know lots of people shudder at the word Oedipal because in the ridiculous textbooks that we all had as undergraduates, it's all about mummy and daddy and sex, which may or may not have some validity, but it trivializes what is actually a very powerful transition period in the way in which the human condition develops. Now, the other normative traumas, I'm sidetracking here. You talked about the influence of Wilhelm Reich on people like Fritz Perls and so forth, and the Esalen Institute. The other person very influential was Otto Rank, who trained under Freud and was one of Freud's favorites, and then came to New York with the Holocaust and actually did therapeutic work with a huge number of people that became leaders in the field. Carl Rogers, Fritz Perls, what was the man name who did primal screen work? Janov? Janov, I think.
Yeah,
all of them, I think, had been in therapeutic work. Rogers, Carl Rogers, had been in therapeutic work where it was a huge influence on the humanistic movement. So you see Otto Rank coming from psychoanalysis and Wilhelm Reich coming from psychoanalysis, one very much emphasizing energy, the other very much emphasizing a sort of humanistic way of thinking about healing. Now, Otto Rank broke with Freud. And why he broke with Freud is he said there has to be trauma that is significant earlier than the Oedipal complex. And what he said was birth trauma, the trauma of birth, which has never really been well understood because it's been abundantly proven that you can't remember your birth.
Yeah.
What you remember are fantasies about your birth that you had subsequently. That's what you come to remember. But then on what are those fantasies based? And of course, what they're based on is the somatic challenge, the somatic trauma of birth. Now, there's a new way of thinking in psychoanalysis, which talks about how the unconscious of caretakers gets somatically transmitted into the infant, and the infant is essentially victim of the somatic transition, the somatic transmission of what Jean Laplanche, the theorist I'm referring to, calls enigmatic messages. And the best example here, which no one wants to talk about because it's not a very polite example. Well, I'll give you two examples. The first example is the mother and the breastfeeding. Now, there is a reflex. It's a purely biological reflex that the infant is born into the world with, the sucking reflex. There's nothing psychological about it. The nipple goes in the mouth. The sucking is automatic. It's like a fixed action pattern that ethologists talk about. But what Laplanche says is, in that suckling, what we ignore is the mother. And not just the mother's sensations, my nipple is being bitten, my nipple feels pleasurably sucked on or whatever, but the mother brings to that episode with the child a whole history of her erotic experiences with her breasts and her teats. And in some subtle way that I think you and I would talk about as a subtle energetic way, but that's not how the French psychoanalysts talk about it, that in a subtle energetic way, all sorts of messages, all sorts of energies are transmitted from the mother to the infant. And of course, the infant doesn't have a mind at this point. It does not have a representational system, cannot possibly make sense of what is going on. And that instigates a rift within us, a normative trauma within us that proves hugely important as we go forth in the world and eventually as toddlers get inducted into the symbolic system of language. I think, I don't know if I'm being as clear as I might be because we have some internet difficulties here, but you have essentially the idea of two normative traumas that are what make us human. And what also comes about there is intergenerational transmission, the intergenerational transmission of trauma that occurs not just on the level of, let me tell you how my grandfather was a slave and was beaten up by white slave owners, blah, blah, although that is that historiography and that autobiographical sensitivity to the oppressive patterns that I'm on the side of the perpetrator of as a white male, and as an English white male, even worse, that sensitivity to what is verbally transmitted is just one level. There's a powerful level of somatic, energetic transmission intergenerationally, which affects our bodies, whether we are the oppressor or the oppressed. And I think this is, we're on the verge in a way of a really important synthesis in understanding a lot of things about how healing needs to occur. And healing cannot be other than somatic to some degree or other. And I think the crucial thing for the future is this idea of subtle energies. Now, you earlier talked about neuroscience. One of the problems I find in the current vogue for neuroscience, and I know the word vogue is slightly pejorative, is that in a way, the belief that computer models of the mind are going to save us actually is yet another version of the Western rationality hegemony that in some way stops us from thinking about subtle energies and therefore presents the development or the further development of healing awareness, the awareness of subtle energies that is so profoundly healing, in which I think you and I believe in, but a large number of people do not. I'm sorry, I think I've just given you a little lecture, which I didn't really mean to do.
Oh, that's what I was asking for. I was asking for your riff on normative trauma, which is quite good because I think it's really important to understand that when we use language, to some extent, we're recapitulating the original rift between the signifier, the thing said, and the whole system of significations and words and so on that represent deities and parents and, a whole linguistic code that kind of is an original rupture. That goes with coming into representational language. And that's a rupture from the actual flow of being in a body. Just in the flow of being in the body. So I think it's really important if we're using language in clinical practice, which we are, right? We're just constantly using language that even if we're really somatically oriented, we got to recognize with humility that language carries with it not only limitations, but we're actually saying, and I think we're actually saying that language itself is a trauma, aren't we?
Yes. Yes. I think that's an excellent way of putting it, actually.
So then it's like, well, And you pointed to this. It's like, in this day and age, trauma is just propagated everywhere, trauma and trauma discourse. And one of the cool things that one of the authors, another author that I really like, This is Stephen Levine, not Peter Levine, Stephen Levine. He says, trauma discourse has become traumatizing. So that there's no way out of it. It's just like it's language on top of signifier on top of signifier.
Yeah.
And if it's language itself, and this goes with Deleuze. Deleuze says that opinion is the woe of the people. You know, the signifiers and the codes and the languages that we bring to trauma and to psychology are just more of the original rupture.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So there's this really rich tradition in critical theory, which I teach at a hub for. I teach at California Institute of Integral Studies as a professor in the somatics department. And we look at things like, you know, the racialized body. And it really is very, very much a hub for understanding the vectors of oppression that that are put upon by you know, Western Eurocentric consciousness onto oppressed bodies and marginalized bodies, right? I mean,
yes.
So there's very much a hub. I'm like right at the hub of that stuff. And, you know, it can be kind of like the good, the bad, and the ugly of that, right? Because there's still a language model that's being used to try to articulate problems that occur through language. Right. It's a mess.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting. You talked about Deleuze earlier, and I think Deleuze has a lot to teach us in this respect when he talks about the plane of immanence and the way things occur. I can't articulate this well off the top of my head, but the way that things occur in terms of our being becoming that are not in fact capturable by analytico-referential use of language. It's important stuff, not sufficiently read, and certainly not mainstream.
So I'm wondering if I can read a quote from the emergence, this wonderful text of yours, Emergence of Somatic Psychology. And this one is about the philosophical and cultural studies element. You mentioned seven isms that I think are important to bring to the table here, that the, you know, the critical theorists are, have become specialists in exposing and bringing to the light of consciousness and so on. So here we go. Because of the West's colonialist ambitions, the cultures of most of the entire globe, there is at least seven tragic isms. These are classism, elitism, racism, and in quotes, you had the very important term ethnocentrism, gender sexism, heterosexism, ageism, and ecocidalism, the killing of nature, essentially. To these, what we must add that the modern way of thinking is profoundly inscribed on all of us in terms of the alienation we are subject to in regards to our embodiment. Perhaps this alienation is indeed central to and the wellspring of all other tragedies. Because rendering our own body as other makes possible a mindset that treats the earth and all its inhabitants as other than ourselves. Just love that. You really nailed
Thank
with
you.
That one.
I'm flattered that you've quoted it. I will stand by it, even though I'd almost forgotten that I wrote it.
Well, that's how it works with writing, right? You're on a journey, right? Things just come through. And even, you know, like something that I wrote even a week ago or whatever, I'm kind of like, who was that? What, you know, that's, you know, how that works, right? You write a lot.
Well, whoever it was that wrote that quote, I think it's pretty good.
Nice one. I like it. There's, again, so much more in terms of the rich traditions and philosophical and cultural studies. You've mentioned, Otto Rank, who I just think is just extraordinarily influential in terms of the pre and perinatal psychology community and all this business about rebirthing and birth trauma. There's a whole subspecialty of somatic psychology called, pre and perinatal psychology specialists who are experts and specialize in birth trauma. And it connects actually quite well with the Esalen Institute, right? And Stanislav and Christina Groff, who created a whole model about psychedelics and birth trauma, proposing that psychedelics essentially put us in touch with a phenomenon like what you've been talking about with birth trauma, and that psychedelics are a way to move through birth trauma. So there's a lot there, right, in terms of the origins of, and it's a really, go for it.
No, I mean, you teach at the California Institute for Integral Studies, and I was chair of somatic psychology at the Santa Barbara Graduate Institute when it existed. And sadly, it went out of business. But we had two graduate PhD programs, one in somatic psychology, which I was in charge of, and the other in pre and perinatal psychology. And for me, pre and perinatal psychology was a fascinating field because from my perspective is somewhat that of a skeptic, that in a way there were some incredible studies that really showed incredibly rich, humanly important things. And then it sometimes felt like it bled over into stuff that I just couldn't go there, that went too far away. But that institute was connected with the Esalen Institute, which was, I don't know the status of the Esalen Institute today, but when you think of what it contributed in the 60s, it was an incredible hub for all sorts of different works, the Stanislav Grof work in particular. But I think that raises other important questions, which we may not get to, but what of the use of pharmacology in healing? Because now we have not only I think it's in North America, I know it's thriving, it's even thriving in Southern Africa, an industry based on mostly Peruvian Amazonian plant medicine, ayahuasca, and people taking ayahuasca journeys and feeling that they've really achieved enlightenment. And then there are a whole lot of us who have taken LSD in the past, if not in the recent present. And now psychiatry, mainstream psychiatry, is looking at LSD once again. And then you get also ketamine and all sorts of things that are being used. And I don't know. I'm agnostic about them. I'm of two minds about them, even though I have myself enjoyed hallucinatory substances. But as a modality for healing, it seems to me it falls into something that we haven't talked about, but is very much to do with the capitalist marketplace, the wish for something that is quicker, faster, and at least ostensibly reasonably deep. And is it really a route to healing, or is it an avoidance of the work that healing usually takes? I mean, as a psychoanalyst, my take always is healing is a long, slow journey. Yes, there are breakthroughs, and maybe breakthroughs can be enhanced by the use of substances. But I don't know your opinion of this as someone interested in neuroscience, but it's an interesting challenge nowadays for the field of psychoanalysis and of somatic psychology and the body-mind therapies. You know, are some of these let's do it quicker brands of healing, are they things, how to what extent should we be skeptical of them? Or to what extent are they really an adjunct to the sort of work that other types of therapists do? I'm very challenged by that question right now, and as yet I'm quite undecided.
Yeah, I would place myself in a very similar camp as you, Barnaby, that there's an archetype in the human mind or a narrative impulse to find a holy grail of some kind, to find something that is going to recreate a sort of promised land. I think that fantasy in the psyche goes really, really deep, that there was some Garden of Eden or some holy and pure and innocent time that existed before the horrible things happened, and that if some sort of chemical or whatever is used, then we'll arrive again at that place, that idealized place. I do believe that idealization is one of the ways of understanding the whole mess that we've been talking about through the whole conversation, positive and negative idealizations. And to idealize psychedelics either positively or negatively,
yeah,
is just an expression of a human compulsion to idealize.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I'm always reminded from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, I think it was Padmasambhava or Guru Rinpoche who said, samsara and nirvana are one. We all know what nirvana is, but the opposite of nirvana is samsara, hell, or another word. So heaven and hell are one. And I always think that's interesting. And it goes along with what I said earlier, my deep, not skepticism, my deep feelings of, my deep feelings of antagonism towards all the healing schools and traditions and brands that say, we can help you achieve self-mastery. We can achieve an integrated, complete system where you will have no troubles anymore. And it is not possible. People don't want to hear that it is not possible. But conflict and contradictoriness, we have to live with. And a genuine healing path, as opposed to what I think is a slightly bogus one, is a matter of coming to terms with the fact that we live with contradiction and conflict within. There's something... I'd like to follow up from the quote that you read, which is a distinction that was in my 1993 book, which again, no one has read because it's long, long ago. It was republished in 2016, which was Psychoanalysis and the Postmodern Impulse. And I think there's an important distinction between alienation and estrangement. That in a certain sense, when we are alienated from our body, we are fixated in some sort of a rift between what we think of as our body and what we think of as our mind. And that a healing act is to bring them into relationship with each other, to mobilize them pre-associatively or somatically in improvisational dance or whatever. What we're doing is bringing things into motion. Not resolving conflict, but bringing things into motion that releases blocks and allows energy to flow. But you never are not estranged. There is always an estrangement. Alienation can be healed, but estrangement is the human condition, that there are conflicts and contradictions that will all within us that will always be there. And I personally think that's it's a mostly unpalatable message, because people want to believe that nirvana is achievable and that's the end of the story once we get to be totally enlightened. And I don't think it happens. I think what happens is we have to come to terms with the conflict and the contradictions within ourselves.
That's well said, that there are certain irresolvable tensions inside of the human, in as much as there's irresolvable tensions in the universe. Otherwise, there wouldn't be an infrastructure to birth biological systems anyways. That there's certain irresolvable tensions that are meant to be irresolvable tensions. And that's where I go with it anyways. And I'm vibing with you in the sense that there's this compulsion to fantasize that there's going to be an end to tension or an end to conflict by, for example, researching, studying, and applying dopamine research, dopamine dynamics. Like, that's the scientific branch of this stuff, right? If we figure out dopamine physiology and we figure out whatever elements are there, it's going to be watertight and we're going to be able to permanently escape boredom, for example, or permanently escape misery, or you know, permanently escape that there's something, and I'm with you on this, that there's something inside the human that is like an orphan.
Like an orphan.
You know, like an orphan. Like an orphan.
Way to put it.
Well, that's the way that Deleuze put it. So I'm not going to lay claim to it, but he says that the unconscious is an orphan. That the orphan is the unconscious, and it vibes quite a bit with what you're saying about, you know, not, what was the other word? Not alienation, but
estrangement.
Estrangement. That there's
estrangement is a mobilized condition. Things are moving. Where alienation, at least in the way I'm using the words, really means that things are stuck, they're fixated. And that's in a way the difference. That's why I think healing involves mobilization, whether it's free association or improvisational dance that you were imitating earlier in our conversation. There's a way that mobilizing doesn't resolve into a perfectly integrated human being. That's not possible. And it's a false goal, but mobilization has the healing, the properties to heal, to move us out of alienated conditions into something that is lighter, for want of a better word.
That's great. So like in the Deleuzian tradition, you have this image of the orphan unconscious being nomadic and an image of mobility, that there's always in between, there's an and it indicates a kind of free associative mobility and nomadic capacity to make connections between things that at first blush seem really dissimilar, and a kind of imagination and mobility that exists in the body and in the mind. So, and maybe we can start by wrapping up it, going towards the last couple things that you mentioned in this framework for understanding the history. And one of them is the Western traditions of bodywork. And, you know, so you have all these traditions that I do believe are expressing some element of this urge that we're articulating right now, the urge towards movement, the urge towards mobility. And, you know, like traditions, for example, like Rolfing, and just to come back to your, and this is something I didn't know about you that I think is just really cool. There's a lot of overlap here. I taught in the field of craniosacral biodynamics for many years, which is essentially a pre and perinatal psychology. So I was very much embedded in the craniosacral biodynamics for quite some time until I touched into a ceiling, right? Where it just felt like the coded language and the rituals and stuff like that. I just ended up getting a bit bored with it and felt a bit kind of immobile. In their attempts to nurture mobility, as so many systems do, I think, there ends up being an undercutting of mobility.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that's interesting.
There's so many different traditions.
Yeah. No, but as you talk about Rolfing is interesting because I don't think that Ida Rolf really had a notion of subtle energy, but maybe I'm wrong. It seemed that it was all to do with the fascia tissue and the freezing of the fascia tissue and the mobilizing or the unfreezing of it. So that's a very interesting example, actually. And you're referring to her as part of the Western systems of bodywork. Though in a way, yeah, I mean, in a way that's very contemporary. I tried in the book to think about pre-20th century systems of Western bodywork, and I found it very difficult. It's sort of somewhat there in the literature on paganism, But I thought in a way that was one of the weaker sections of the book.
Well, it'd be really nice to know what they were doing down in Blombos Cave. Have you been to Blombos?
No.
Oh gosh, when I hopefully someday I'll come down to visit you and I'll go on a pilgrimage to Blombos. Blombos Cave, for you listeners out there, is a archaeological site and is the place on planet Earth in southern Africa that it was the longest continuous habitation in human history, 30,000 years of continuous human habitation. And all of that, you know, this is, people survived through the great volcanic winter of the Mount Toba eruption by going into Blombos and so on. But like, I like to think sometimes that there was elements that were pre-language. There was that it was kind of like on the bridge somewhere between, you know, not having a language and having a language. I like to think sometimes of what type of body work might those folks have done before they had linguistic systems, before we had linguistic systems.
Yeah, that's a good and interesting speculation. You know, as you move us towards closing for the evening, or for whatever it is, morning where you're at, we've talked very little about sexuality. And one of the things I'd like just to drop into this podcast, because I think it's important, is the whole history of the field of sexology, the field of the study of human sexuality. Once it was destroyed in Europe because of the rise of Nazism, and it came to America, and it came to America in two forms, either the Kinsey form, which was the fervor to collect statistics about what people were doing, what sex acts, or that Masters and Johnson lineage in which we want to look at the physiology of how people commit sex acts. But I think actually, and this I think comes right from somatic psychology, I think both ways of thinking about sexuality as a matter of what we designate sex acts. And of course, what we designate sex acts is actually quite difficult to define. You know, if you kiss your great aunt on the cheek, that's not a sex act. If you kiss her on the lips with a tongue, that's a sex act. I mean, it's all sort of rubbing noses for the Inuit is a sex act, blah, 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 blah. It's very difficult actually to define what are sex acts. But I think that whole history of the way of approach to thinking about sexuality is fallacious. And I think one thing that we as somatic psychologists can contribute is that sexuality is really a matter of energy movements within our embodiment, and that the way to think about sexuality is how we live in our bodies. So it's not a specific category of act. It's a matter of the whole of us, holistically, how we live in our bodies and how our bodies interact with the universe as well as with other human beings. And I want to end on that because too often we avoid talking about sexuality. As healers, too many of us avoid talking about sexuality because we're afraid it's going to ruin our reputation in polite society. And of course, that we have to be ethically hugely careful about abuses that occur within the various industries of healing. But I think reapproaching human sexuality in a more holistic way has a future in a way that talking about sex acts really has almost exhausted itself in terms of its being a way of thinking about the human condition. Sorry, that was propagandistic, but I wanted to throw it in.
Oh, it's great. I love that you are rigorously interested in keeping sex in the discussion of therapy, that you're a sex-positive therapist, you're a sex-positive individual who does free associative work that I just think is just so wonderful. I like to use the phrase that our civilization is simultaneously sex-obsessed and sex-repressed.
Oh, that's straight out of one of my books. In the book I wrote...
Saying the same thing?
Yeah. Sexual Health and Erotic Freedom, I talk about the sexification of American culture. Because if you look at what has happened since the 1950s, sex is much more on the surface of cultural life. Yeah? Sex is everywhere. It's on billboards. It's on the internet. And you can make the mistake of thinking that therefore we are less afraid of sex. But I think in many, many respects, we're as afraid of sexuality and the intensity of our eroticism as we've ever been. But the way it's dealt with is either phobically or obsessively, both of which are manifestations of fear. So I'm totally behind what you just said. And in a slightly different language, I wrote about that back in 2006.
Brilliant. Yeah, there's some in school when I'm teaching, whenever the discussion about erotic transference comes up, it's easier for clinicians and students to talk about erotic transferences coming from the client or the student or whatever towards the therapist. But the thing that often gets left out is the erotic field of the therapist.
Right.
And it's like seeing that some, you know, and it's like, what are we supposed to do here? Just be on some place apart, some transcendental space beyond all sexuality or something? Like, you know, it's crazy.
In 1988, which wasn't so long ago, I presented to the Psychoanalytic Institute that I trained in a paper in which I had started to feel sexual feelings that the patient was not talking about anything to do with sex. She was droning on and on and on. But 5 minutes later, she started to talk about something sexual in a way that was quite unusual. In other words, the body is a listening instrument, and our somatic reactions as a way of listening to our patients is hugely important. But you can't say the somatic reactions are hugely important, but let's leave out ones that are designated as erotic. The other thing that's interesting, of course, is that traditionally in the psychoanalytic literature, people are far more comfortable talking about the client or patient having hostile reactions to us than erotic reactions to us. There's a huge literature on hostility in the transference and countertransference, much less on erotic arousal in the transference and countertransference. Yeah.
Yeah. And it goes back to this kind of this ideal, this transcendental idealization of the therapist, that somehow the therapist as a cultural construct is somehow beyond the biggies, right? The erotic feelings and hostile feelings. Like,
right.
And this positioning, this transcendental positioning of the therapist as beyond it all is just a lie.
Mm, absolutely. But it's a lie that's very convenient for people in training as mental health professionals.
The other one, just to name this at the end, the other big taboo I find, I do an informal evaluation with students about how much they've talked about the psychodynamics of envy during their graduate psychology training. And I have way less than 1%, Barnaby, talking about envy. And I think envy is radically important and as taboo, if not more, than sex.
Now, that's interesting. And I don't know. I'd have to think about that. I also would have to talk about if there's a meaningful distinction between envy and jealousy, which is a very big muddle in the literature, and the psychoanalytic literature constantly muddles them up. But envy is extremely pernicious, and I'd have to think about it, but I think you may well be right. It's a quite Kleinian insight to think that envy is very basic and very, very toxic.
Well, if we agree that idealization is like the woe of our species, positive and negative idealization, which I saw you nodding rigorously before, then envy has everything.
I've got to think more about it, but I am nodding, yes.
Well, let's talk more about this, you know, in the future. I do think that, you know, with idealization comes envy, and that envy is an underrepresented topic. I do have a distinction between envy and jealousy that I could offer. Should I leave it as being enigmatic and something I articulate later, or should I just throw that down right here? What do you think?
It depends if I'm going to agree with it or not. If I don't agree with it, we're off on a longer discussion. If I agree with it, I'll just nod.
I'd love to talk with you more about that topic. I think it's a radically important topic, and so I hope that we can have another chat, because it feels like there's all sorts of segments of the discussion and branches of the tree of this discussion that could branch out in some really creative and fun directions.
Yeah.
So I feel like there are plenty of opportunities to talk more.
Yeah, I agree. And I very much, if we're wrapping up now, I very much enjoyed our chat and I thank you for inviting me.
Likewise, Barnaby. Great to chat with you, and I hope we'll be in touch.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to The Boundless Body with the Somatic Doctor. Please leave a comment, subscribe, and like us on social media.
We're a swarm. We're a colony. We're a multiplicity.
Until next time, be well.